sounding nasal.
In this next section,
the most important thing to know is that Ambergris, the imaginary city in which this book is set, has an underground area in which the indigenous inhabitants of the city have been driven underground, and they're called the Grey Caps, and they may or may not have intentions of coming back up and taking over the city. They may or may not have some kind of advanced fungal technology or whatever. But this is from Janice's point of view. This is a time in her life when her art gallery has exploded and she experiences a success that she is incapable of dealing with and begins a downward spiral. And this is where the spiral ends. And she's typing this in a bar, so that's where the first phrase comes from. So if you can hear me through all this noise, lean close, listen, and I will tell you a kind of truth that once made sense to me and may again, in time, undergo that startling transformation from madness to the purest form of sanity. If you're feeling low, if you're so full of poison that you can find no light within you, if everywhere you look you see only bitterness or despair, if all these conditions and situations apply to you, I recommend a refreshing suicide attempt. No matter what the so-called experts might say, a suicide attempt will clean you right out. True, it will also squeeze from your body the last remnants of the last smile, the last laugh, the last scrap of hope of any small, shy, but still bright part of you that ever cared about anything. Nothing remained, not religion, not friends, not family, not even love. A carcass picked clean and lying forgotten by the side of the road, a hollowed-out statue, a wisp of mist off the river. But that doesn't last, how could it? And at least it drains the poison. So that even in your isolation from yourself, you feel gratitude, which fades in turn because at the end, you don't even feel numb. Because to feel numb implies that at some point you were not numb, and so you feel like you don't really exist anymore. Which is the truest sort of truth. After a suicide attempt, you don't really exist anymore, just the images of you in other people's eyes. Later, much later, as I stared at the blood welling up from an accidental pen puncture, absent-minded and remote from the pain, I was amused at how concerned doctors get about such things. One would have thought a gardening convention had blossomed around the fertile flower bed of my body for all the quick consternation they displayed at this pinprick, which belonged to a different world than my poor wrist sliced to the bone. I could see the bone wink through at me the night I did it, as if it shared the joke in a way the blood could not. The blood wanted only to escape, but the good solid bone, it ground against the knife. It made me reconsider, if only for a moment. Craven, quivering flesh, foolish blood, and bone winking through. I wish I could remember what it said to me. I remember only fragments, the roar of blood as it raced away, drowned out the murmur of the bones. Besides, I was preoccupied. I was laughing because my hand flopped off the end of my wrist in a way I found hilarious. I was shaking so hard that I could not hold the knife to cut my other wrist. This was simply the most stunning miscalculation I'd ever made. I flopped around like a half-dead fish, unable to finish what I had started, but had no one to help me out. Even funnier, I almost tore myself apart with laughter over this one. I was not enveloped in the warm hum of numbness, not so lucky, no. The pain blazed through me as intensely as if my blood were boiling as it left me. So intense, my laugh became a scream. My scream, sometimes something beyond even the vocal cords of an animal. Death, it seemed, wasn't all that much fun after all. Especially when I became vaguely aware that someone had smashed in the door and was carrying me out of the apartment, and he was weeping louder than I was. So you can imagine my amusement over the doctor's concern about my thumb prick. The prick should have been more concerned about where I found the pen, and where they had made me stay, and whose company I had been keeping. For you see, the Moss Bender Memorial Mental Hospital is not what I would call the most hospitable of accommodations. I will not be recommending it to my friends and family. I will not be tipping generously. Indeed, I will not even be stealing the bath towels or the little soaps from the shower. Strange life to end up in a place like that. An ivy-shrouded fortress of cruel stone and sharp angles, and gray like the inside of a dead squid, gray like a gray cat, gray like a thunderstorm, but not as interesting. Little windows like crow-pecked eyes, not even round or square, but misshapen. Had former inmates chiseled at them, attempting to escape? If you looked at the gray stone up close, you could see that it wasn't even just stone. A type of gray fungus had coated those walls. It fitted over the stone like skin. You could almost see the walls breathing. Smells. Did I mention smells? The smell of sour porridge, the smell of rotting cheese, the smell of unwashed others, stench of garbage sometimes wafting up from the lower levels, oil, piss, shit, all of it covered by the clean smell of soap and wax, but not covered well enough. Intertwined with the echo of smells came the echo of sounds, screams so distant behind padded walls that I sometimes thought they came from inside my own head. The panting of inmates like animals in distress, a low screeching warble for which I could never find a source. The hallways were like corridors to bad dreams. They rambled this way and that with no order and no coherence. You might find your destination or you might not. It all depended on luck. I remember that once I turned a corner and there was a dandelion growing out of a clump of dirt on the floor. After that, I wouldn't have been surprised if the lower levels were vast swamps or brambles through which inmates thrashed their way to open space. Once, I swear, I even saw a gray cat in the distance, running away from me toward a doorway. But I was not particularly stable. Who knows what I really saw? All this grand design, this palace, was run by a man they called only Dr. B, as if his last name were so hideous or so forbidden that even saying Dr. B aloud might lead to some punishment. I had the impression that the man's name was very long. All I know is I never saw him, not once, during my stay in those glorious apartments, those rooms fit for a king, or at least a rat king. But as bad as the facilities might have been, I found my fellow inmates more disturbing. My new best friends were predictably all depressed, suicidal people. If you want to make a suicidal person even more depressed, keep them cooped up with several other suicidal people. That's what I always say. My friends included Martha of the Order of Eating Disorders, who looked like a couple of wet matchsticks sewn together with skin, a writer who would not give his name and thought he had created all of us, Sandra, who had suffered through experimental treatments involving street lamps and an engine from a motored vehicle that could have cooked a couple of hundred dinners, Daniel, who had reason to be devoid of hope, his deformity had fused his two legs into one stump that fed into his head, which had stuck to his shoulder in an unattractive way, and of course Edward. Edward was different from the rest, and he stayed away from us at first. I would see him in the mornings, hunched in a corner, short, dressed all in gray, with a large felt hat, bright, dark eyes that peered from a pale, slack face. His hands had long, dirty nails that looked as if they might snap off at the slightest suggestion of a breeze. A stale, dull, rotting smell came from his general direction, which I later discovered was due to the mushrooms he kept about his person. Sometimes he made little chirping sounds akin to the cricket that sang to me from outside my cell when the moon was full. Edward, according to the experts, thought he was a gray cat. His misfortunes included losing his job as a bookbinder for Frank Ryan and Luton, falling in love with a woman who could not possibly love him back, the recent death of his grandfather, his only living relative, and not being taken seriously. He'd swallowed whole handfuls of poisonous mushrooms. The landlady had found him in time, but only because she stopped by to inquire about the lateness of the rent. He should have been grateful, but he was not. In Edward, I seemed to have found someone who was a distant cousin to my brother Duncan. I told Edward, with dull sunlight seeping through the dusty, fungal filigree of the dull windows in that dull common room with dull faded carpets and dull faded paint covered with lichen, while we and the other dull inmates sat in our stupid dull deck chairs, waiting to start another dull, hopeless session of rehabilitation with a woman so cheerless and uninteresting that I cannot even conjure up a shadow of her name. I told him about the singing of the blood, the murmuring of the bone, and he agreed it sounded like a much superior method. The mushrooms he had taken had made his body fall asleep. A knife wound, on the other hand, spoke to you in a myriad of voices. It told you how you really felt. He nodded like he understood. I nodded back as if I knew what I was talking about. Edward only spoke to me using his chirps and whistles and the occasional drawing. He always drew tunnels, crisscrossing tunnels, honeycombing tunnels, tunnels without end. He used black chalk or charcoal on butcher's paper. That was all we had in there to chart our creativity. I know, I told him, I know, you want to go underground, like my brother. My brother's been underground, trust me, you don't want to go there. Chirp, chirp, whistle, huge eyes glistening from beneath his hat and his cowl. No, no, trust me, Edward, the world above ground holds more than enough for you if you give it a chance, I replied, even though I didn't believe a word of it. Some days I made fun of Edward, some days I thought he was more in love with the whole idea of the gray cats than my brother. Some days I thought he was my brother. I was never crazy, just committed. One day, on an impulse, I silenced his chirping with a hug. I held him tight, and I could feel his body shudder, relax, and melt into that embrace. I heard him whisper a word or two. I could not understand the words, but they were human. He did not want to let go. Something inside of him didn't believe in his own insanity. And suddenly I found myself holding him tighter and crying and not believing in my insanity either. Soon enough, though, the guards pulled us apart and we each returned to our separate madness. Over time, the days took on a sameness in that place, a crushing, gray sameness. The only relief came in the form of my art gallery assistant, Sybil, who visited two or three times. He let me know how my reputation fared in the outside world, not well, and brought with him get-well-soon cards from Siren Lake and several other clients. Siren had written his using letters cut from the wings of dead butterflies, while Lake had scrawled a sketch and an indecipherable message that appeared to be an attempt at a pun that had gone horribly wrong. Startling proof of my former life running a gallery for unstable artist types. And yet that whole life seemed unreal, as if I had never lived it. I felt as if I were receiving messages from foreign lunatics. "When are you coming back?" Sybil asked as he held my hand. I could see real sympathy in his eyes, not just pity. I shrugged. "It depends. On what?" he asked. "On when Duncan's money runs out." Duncan's money had been funding my entire stay. "Where is Duncan anyway?" "I don't know. I think he's gone underground." The truth was, Duncan never visited me. I never asked him why. I didn't want to know. "How's the gallery?" I asked Sybil. "As well as could be expected with Lake gone and you recovering." "Recovering, a nice word for it." "What word would you like me to use?" Sybil asked. A glint of anger showed in his expression. It was the only time I angered him, or the only time I saw his anger. "Any other word, Sybil," I said. "Any word that conveys just how fucked up I am." Sybil laughed. "Just look at your sympathy cards. You're not the first and you won't be the last." I stayed in that place for 5 months until it became clear that I needed additional help, the kind that could not be provided at the hospital. At least they realized I would not try again. That madness was over with, although I had nightmares. 2 days before I left that place for a succession of other places, Edward told me he loved me as we played another ludicrous game of lawn bowling in the tiny interior courtyard, around which the building curled like a half-open fist. Me unable to hold the ball because of my traitorous wrist, him short-sighted and uncoordinated. Our legendary games lasted for brutal hours of incompetence while Martha, Daniel, the nameless writer, and Sandra watched with a kind of disinterested interest. This was the first time Edward had used recognizable human speech. Applying the doctor's advice, like a universal salve for any ill, I told Edward the truth. At the moment, I had no capacity for any kind of love. I did not love him back. I didn't love anyone back. I wouldn't have loved myself back if I'd walked past myself on a deserted street. The day before I left, Edward used a variation on the Janus Shriek method to try to kill himself. He stood in his corner as usual, his hands hidden, as he cut at his wrists with a dull piece of metal he'd loosened from the underside of one of the deck chairs. He slowly rubbed the skin and flesh off his wrists until the blood came and his body trembled with the anticipation of stillness. He stood there for at least 15 minutes, propped up by the wall, the blood hidden by his gray robes. He must have been very determined. I imagine the blood sang softly to him, comforting him. So I imagine. The truth must have a harder, sharper edge. It certainly did for those of us who had not noticed him in his corner killing himself. Luckily or unluckily, an attendant discovered Edward's sin before it could claim him. I swear I felt no guilt over the incident. It hurt terribly. No, it didn't. I cried for hours, and I couldn't. He had bright, wide eyes, and he had a mind that could feel. I didn't have anything inside me. My troubles looked so trivial next to his. Would it have hurt so much to say I loved him when I didn't? I couldn't even feel anger or despair. No despair for me today, thank you. Just an endless, cool desert, and a breeze blowing, and the sun going down, and this sense of calm eating at me. I only knew him for a few months, and yet it hurt me terribly. The memories of me would most likely be triggered every time he saw the scars on his wrist. As it was, I never saw Edward again, or learned what happened to him, or any of the other patients in that place. I had just been passing through. Thank you.
A few extra minutes, and if you have questions or comments, interactions. I want to talk to Patrick about cello repertoire and Bach.